This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society at the University of Virginia, made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Hundreds of hours of lectures and more at civilpodcast.com. The Society's guest on October 3rd, 2008 is Charles Bryan, the President and CEO of the Virginia Historical Society.
Thank you all for coming out tonight for this week's meeting of the Jefferson Literary and Debate Society. My name is Mark Garfield, and I'm the president. We're pleased and proud tonight to host Dr. Charles Bryan, President and CEO of the Virginia Historical Society. Dr. Bryan will be presenting a speech tonight entitled Books That Have Changed the Course of American History. Dr. Bryan has served as the president of the Virginia Historical Society since 1988. He's overseen fundraising efforts of over $100 million for research initiatives, historical preservation projects, and statewide education programs. In the past, Dr. Bryan has taught at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, the University of Tennessee, and Arizona State University. Recently, he was recognized by the Virginia General Assembly in 2008 for distinguished service and contributions to scholarship. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Dr. Charles Bryan.
Thank you, Bella. Thank you. Thank you. I am deeply honored to speak to the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society. I'm impressed that it's Friday night, football weekend, and you're here. That was a very generous introduction, Bailey. Bailey spent several days with us at the Historical Society a few years ago as a Blanton Scholar, a wonderful program we have at the Virginia Historical Society. She did not mention that I'm retiring in 57 days. I'm not counting, but I am looking forward to that. It's been a wonderful career. My wife, Cammie, is with us. We met in Lexington. Her father was my math professor at VMI. I flunked his class, and I flunked chemistry, and I had to come back to summer school, and we met in the meantime and fell in love. We were having dinner the other night and reflecting on my career, and it has been a wonderful career, an exciting career, and I said, honey, in your wildest dreams, did you ever think we would be where we are? She looked at me and said, Charlie, you never were in my wildest dreams. So, now, one thing I have to tell you, I have Parkinson's disease, so if my hand gets shaky, I'm not going through the DTs. I didn't warn Bailey about this, but those of us who have Parkinson's, it takes longer to do things, to get dressed, to get in and out of a car. Takes me an hour and a half to watch 60 Minutes now, but this used to be a 40-minute talk. It's up to about 2 hours now, Bailey. I'm sorry. So, anyway, I want to talk about books that changed the course of American history. I've started work on a book that, in a way, is related to that, that I've titled Turning Points. Now, we know there are turning points in history, Pearl Harbor, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, Lincoln's assassination. But I argue that each of us individually have personal, profound turning points in our lives. Either a decision you made or something that happened to you in which your life changed. And quite often you don't recognize that until later. And I've organized the book into chapters. One is called Serendipity. Had you been 5 minutes late to a meeting, your life would have been very different. One is called Epiphany. You're on a walk or a run and an idea comes to you. Or you wake up in the middle of the night and an idea comes to you and it changes your life. One called Temptation, either giving in to temptation or not giving in to temptation, which can change your life. Love, have a chapter titled Fall In for those who've served in the military, and it's a turning point in their lives. And I'm interviewing people of power, wealth, and influence about the turning points in their lives. Interviewed John Glenn, Ross Perot, which was most interesting, I might say. I've interviewed Doug Wilder, Charlie Gibson of ABC News I've interviewed. And anyway, I have a whole list, and when I retired, I really want to get into this. And it's made me realize that certain things happen in life. Being late for that meeting or that idea can change history. And I've always been interested in those things that cause changes in history that are turning points. There's even a show on the Weather Channel now, how weather has affected history. Those of you who may be Weather Channel addicts are aware of that, Eisenhower and the D-Day decision and so on and so forth. But I started thinking about this a few years ago, about certain books that were published and read, and I can argue that they influenced the course of American history. And that's what I want us to do tonight, is to look at the books that I think have changed the course of American history. And what we're going to do, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you what they are. I'm going to give you certain hints, and I'm going to allow you to guess what they are as we go through. Now, this is not Jeopardy. I don't want you shouting out the answer, and I know that all of you probably know the answers to this, and you're going to be so tempted to show off to the people sitting next to you that you know what these are. You must control yourself. So try to keep these to yourself as much as possible. But I have 11 books on my list that I want to share with you this evening, and let me give you the criteria of my list of books. And first of all, they clearly had a long-term effect on public opinion, on the thinking and actions of government leaders or officials, or the way people did things. They changed the way people did things. That's number one. Two, these are books that were published in the United States, or what would become the United States, by native-born American authors, with three exceptions. Third is they were not necessarily bestsellers. They were not necessarily bestsellers at their time during when they were published. Some were. And most did not have genuine literary merit. And you won't find them in college anthologies. And some of these were not necessarily published originally as books. They may have come out as a pamphlet and then eventually ended up in books. And no book on my list has been published within the last 48 years. I think you need 50 years to determine if it has any influence on history. And last, and this is the most important of all, there's no right or wrong answer. This is purely subjective. This is my list. You can agree or disagree with me. You may have your own books, but this is what I think are the books that changed the course of American history. And to help get us through this, we're going to do these in chronological order. I thought about mixing them up to make it a little more challenging, but it is Friday night. So, all right, are you ready? All right, don't shout out now. This is the first book on my list was published or was written by one of our three non-native-born Americans. This person was born in Norfolk, England. And for the first 35 years of his or her life, this person lived in poverty, was self-educated. The person was brilliant, but was self-educated. And then in the early 1770s, this person, and I'll tell you, it's a man, had a turning point. He met Benjamin Franklin in London and greatly impressed Benjamin Franklin with his knowledge and particularly his criticism of the monarchy and the British system of government. And Franklin persuaded him to move to the American colonies. He moved to Philadelphia in 1774, and he began to work for the Pennsylvania Magazine. And then in 1776, he published a pamphlet that was powerful, that had a profound influence on public opinion at the time. All right, I will ask you, name?
Thomas Paine.
The publication?
Common Sense.
And in stirring, powerful language, and in many ways very simple language, he advocated independence from the crown. 500,000 copies of this pamphlet. That's a lot. That's a lot today. Were distributed throughout the American colonies, and they clearly had a profound influence in shaping public opinion. Now, I'm not sure if you know what happened to him after that. Once the war broke out, he joined the Continental Army. He was an aide to Nathaniel Greene. And in 1777, he published another pamphlet. Anybody remember what that is? It's called The Crisis. And in it, he said, "These are times that try men's soul." It was a very difficult period during the Revolution. And he tried to stir up morale in the American Continental Army and among the Patriot cause. Well, he finished the war, and after the war, he lived quietly for a while in New York and then moved back to England. Many people don't know this, but Thomas Paine was an inventor, and he had invented the concept for an iron bridge. And he tried to market it, but he got himself in big trouble because he kept criticizing the king, King George III and the monarchy, and he kept going, and he was not welcome. He was not having very much luck marketing his bridge, so he moves to France. And he moves to France in the early 1790s, and we, of course, know what's going on there, the French Revolution. He becomes a part of that, embraces it fully, but like many other people involved in the French Revolution, they began to eat their own. He was arrested, came very close to being executed himself, but he managed to get out of it. He comes back to the United States and lives in New York and died in 1809 in New York. They took his bones back to England in 1819, and they've been lost. So if anyone ever finds his bones, you will have found the bones of a very significant figure in American history. But Thomas Paine, Common Sense. All right, second publication. This is the only publication on my list that has multiple authors. And they first appeared as a series of essays and newspapers and pamphlets, and then eventually published in book form. I can see you all mouthing these. You're being very good. There were 85 essays in all, and they advocated the ratification of the new U.S. Constitution. All right, what are we talking about? All right, the three authors, John Jay, Madison, and Hamilton. Which one wrote the majority? Hamilton. He wrote the majority. Two-thirds of the essays were written by Hamilton. What is significant about his, he's one of three non-natives. He was born in the Caribbean. But as you know, the Articles of Confederation were the form of government in which the United States was governed in the 1780s, placing most power with the states. There was a strong cry for a stronger centralized government. A constitutional convention met in 1787 to beef up the Articles, and they went probably too far, and they scrapped the Articles of Confederation and replaced them with the Constitution. It had to be ratified, and there was by no means any guarantee that the states would ratify this. There was a lot of opposition, particularly here in Virginia. Do you remember who led the opposition in Virginia? Patrick Henry was the most vocal spokesman against the new Constitution. And New York was another pivotal state. And the essays were distributed, and they began to sway public opinion. And particularly Hamilton played a tremendous influence in New York. And eventually New York fell into line and ratified the Constitution, and then Virginia fell in line. And by 1789, we had the new government. But some historians argue that the Federalists are rank up there near the top as the most influential publication in changing the course of American history. All right, I'm going to be very curious to see if you get this one, the next one, my third one. The author was born in Pennsylvania in 1800, but when this author was 2 years old, the family of the author moved to Ohio. This person had little formal schooling, and this seems to be a common theme. He had a brilliant mind, was self-educated, and by the time, I'll tell you, he was 18, he began to teach school. And finally, when he was in his early 20s, he decided he needed to go to college, and he came back and went to college in Pennsylvania, Washington College in Pennsylvania, and studied theology, religion, went back to Ohio, and taught for a while at Miami University in Ohio. And then in 1829, he was ordained as a Presbyterian minister. And he taught religion and philosophy and theology, and he became president of Cincinnati College. And then in 1845, he was appointed a professor at the University of Virginia. And it was a controversial appointment. Why would it have been controversial? He was the first faculty member who was ordained, appointed to the faculty of the University of Virginia. And there was a lot of concern that this was a secular university and there should be no teaching of religion, and it did create quite a stir. But he stayed and had a rather distinguished record. He was particularly interested in education and teaching, and he was very concerned about the teaching of reading and writing in schools. And he felt that the textbooks that were available to young people in schools were very weak, were very poor. So in 1836, before he came here, he published a book that represented a great improvement over the types of books and textbooks that were used in schools. And they would eventually go into several editions, and they would be used in one form or another in American schools well into the first quarter of the 20th century. Who are we talking about? William Holmes McGuffey. William Holmes McGuffey, he published the Eclectic Reader, which became known as the McGuffey's Readers. And they were basically anthologies of English and American literature, and they were a great improvement over what had been used in schools before. They were very popular. They became the standardized text in American schools, as I said, well into the 20th century. Compared to what had been used before, they were of high intellectual level, and they emphasized morality and patriotism. And there's some sense that they contributed to the sense of manifest destiny in the mid-19th century. And they did have a great influence on American education in the 19th century. And I ask you where the burying ground is at the burial ground at the University of Virginia. If you've not been there, McGuffey is buried here on the campus of the University of Virginia. And is there a McGuffey Hall? Well, that's where it comes from. Question or? Okay. All right, the next on my list, some historians said, is the most important book in terms of influencing American history. The most important. Our author was born in 1811 into one of the 19th century's most famous families. This author's father was a nationally prominent Congregationalist minister. He became president of Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati. And it was there that, as a young woman, she began to write short stories and articles for magazines and the newspaper. But what had the turning point in her life was when she crossed the Ohio River and went into Kentucky and visited a slave state for the first time and began to observe slavery. And she was profoundly influenced by what she saw. She went back to Cincinnati, got married, and in 1850, she and her new husband moved to Maine, and he was a professor at Bowdoin College. And she sat down, and writing from her notes and sketches, she began to write a story about slavery based on her experience and her observations in Kentucky and what she had seen of escaped slaves in Ohio. And in 1852, the author, by the name of published Uncle Tom's Cabin. And overnight, it became a bestseller, especially in the North. It was the number four bestseller of the 19th century. And as you may know, if you've studied Harriet Beecher Stowe in Uncle Tom's Cabin, it was banned in the South. All but one Southern legislature passed legislation banning its sale and distribution in their states. They said it was scandalous, that it portrayed the wrong picture of slavery. And why was it important? Well, some historians say it was one factor in leading to the Civil War. We do know this, that when Harriet Beecher Stowe met President Abraham Lincoln in 1862 for the first time, he supposedly said, "Here's the little woman who caused this big, great war." And whether that's true or not, it is, I think, representative of the importance of the book. It was widely read, banned in the South. It changed the thinking of many people in the North about slavery. They did not suddenly become abolitionists, but they became sympathetic and aware of the evils of slavery. The book was eventually published in 20 languages. She lectured all over the world. And she was one of the most famous authors of the 19th century, particularly a woman author. And as we say, she may have contributed to the coming of the Civil War. She wrote several other books after this, but they were all greatly overshadowed by Uncle Tom's Cabin. But she would remain well known and famous until her death in Connecticut in 1896. All right, next. And I'll be curious to see if anybody, this, I bet somebody gets this one. Last time I did this, no one got it. All right, this is published after the Civil War. This is the third of our authors born outside of the United States. He was born in Dunfermline, Scotland in 1835. But when he was a young man, and he grew up in poverty, was self-educated. He received very little formal education, for the most part self-educated. He immigrated to the United States in 1848. And moved to Pittsburgh, and he worked in a cotton factory there. And then he got a job as a messenger boy for a Pittsburgh telegraph office. He was brilliant, and he was able to listen to the telegraphers, and he learned how to do it himself by simply listening to it. And then he became a telegrapher, and through hard work and diligence, he became an expert. And then he was hired by the Pennsylvania Railroad to take over their telegraph operation. And then eventually he switched over to totally to railroad operations. And by the time of the Civil War, he was running the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania Railroad operation. And during his time in the war, he saw the construction of lots of rail lines. And he saw that they were using steel. They were replacing the rail lines from iron to steel. And he said, there's a future in it. So after the war, he started his own steel manufacturing companies and plants, and they grew and they grew and they grew. And by the 1880s, he was one of the wealthiest men on the face of the earth. And we're talking about Andrew Carnegie. Do you know what he published? He published a famous essay in 1889 titled The Gospel of Wealth, which if you haven't read it, you ought to read it. And Carnegie's a fascinating man. He became very guilty about his wealth. He had grown up in poverty, had seen poverty, and he had all of this money, and he began to think that it was a sin to have so much money and to accumulate it. And he began to talk about the distribution of wealth, that we owe it, that we have been selected naturally. It was a Darwinian theory to be wealthy. And to share, and it is our obligation to share it to uplift the rest of society. And here's what he did that would have an influence. He advocated an estate tax, now known by some as the death tax. He clearly spoke out very clearly in this essay, and we continue to talk about the estate tax. He said, the worst thing we could do is pass our wealth on to the next generation, particularly our children. Because it would lead to a society and class structure much like what we see in Europe. And he came from that. He said that the children it'll be a lazy, indolent class of people if we pass wealth on. And he advocated the estate tax. The estate tax didn't become reality until 1916 during the Wilson administration, and Congress passes the estate tax. That one who has an estate gets taxed on it. But we Americans try to figure out any way we can get out of being taxed. Called loopholes. And within a matter of years, legislation was passed that if you took part of your estate and gave it to charity, you would not be taxed on what you gave to charity. A few years later, Congress passes the individual income tax deduction. Then in 1935, the corporate income tax deduction. And the importance of this is that in the entire world, 85% of philanthropic giving to philanthropies and charities comes from the United States. We're one of the few countries in the world that when you give to the Red Cross, when you give to the Virginia Historical Society, you can get a tax deduction for doing it. And it has led to the proliferation of more nonprofits, total numbers, and per capita than any other country in the world. Now, is that a stretch saying the gospel of wealth? Maybe a little bit, but I think it had a profound influence. And when that debate was being, when the debates were being brought forward in Congress for the income tax, Carnegie was cited many times, and of course he was a great giver of charity. So the gospel of wealth, Andrew Carnegie. Next one. This book had profound influence beyond the United States, within the United States and beyond. Our author was the son of a West Point professor. He, however, was a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He became a professor of history, he had a PhD in history, and eventually became president of the American Historical Association. And he was particularly interested in the history of navies and the military. And he published a book in the 1890s that was read in the United States, that was read in England, was read in Germany, was read in Russia, and read in Japan. And it had a profound influence on the building up of fleets in the world. And this gentleman here with the bow tie is... Alfred Thayer Mahan, or Mann, Mahan is a... And it's the influence, let's push the next, the influence of sea power on history. And in it, he said, great nations, great empires have great navies, and they have naval bases throughout their sphere of influence. And it was a book that Theodore Roosevelt read. It was very influential in these countries. And you begin to see in the 1890s and in the early 20th century, the buildup of fleets. There's a fascinating book by Robert Massey titled Castles of Steel. And he talks about the buildup of these navies. And this is a book that clearly its influence went well beyond that of the United States. And the interesting thing is that Mahan died in 1914 just as World War I was breaking out. Now, he didn't cause World War I, but his influence in the building up of these fleets, there is irony in the year of his death. All right, next. Our person was a native of Baltimore. And he was a reformer. Yeah, we've got some Baltimoreites in here. He published several books, but they didn't have quite the influence that this one did. And he was very interested in social and political problems that existed at the turn of the 20th century. And his most famous story, there's an apocryphal story that Theodore Roosevelt was in the White House eating breakfast, and he was eating sausage and reading this book. And as he read it, he became so upset he threw the book out the window in his plate of sausage, because it was about the problem of the problems of the meatpacking industry. And who was it? Upton Sinclair, the book, The Jungle. And it was a story of an immigrant family in Chicago that worked in the Chicago stockyards, and he described in very lurid, I don't know if you've ever read it, very lurid detail what all went into the meatpacking. There were no regulations, no inspections. And he actually had been commissioned by the Socialist Weekly to produce a series of stories, and this turned out to into the novel The Jungle. And this led to the Meat Inspection Act, and for the first time in American history, the regulation of food products. And it's the beginning of regulating not only food products, but other consumer products. And I think this is a clear example that book had a profound influence and was cited by members of Congress as they advocated and passed that legislation. He ran for the presidency several times on the socialist ticket, and died in New Jersey in 1968. And I can remember, I'm old enough to remember that. All right, next on our list. And this is the number two bestseller of the 20th century other than the Bible. And I would venture to say that your parents or your grandparents probably still have or had it in their bookshelf at home. Some people blame the problems of the baby boom generation on this book. And it is written by the only medical doctor on my list. Anybody want to guess? Benjamin Spock, Child Care. And it was a huge seller. Now, why was it important, and what was its significance? Child-rearing books prior to that talked about being stern with your children and don't get too lubby-dubby with them and don't be too soft. You have to control them. But Spock, on the other hand, said you need to be tender and soft and loving with your children, understand them, listen to them. And he was someone who was very much against spanking of children. And so the book is actually in two parts, one about how to treat a cold or a cut or something like that, but the other half was on how to raise your children. and child rearing changed significantly with the publication of this book. And again, some people blame my generation on the publication of Baby and Child Care by Benjamin Spock. All right, next. Another Pennsylvanian. This person early in life developed an abiding interest in the natural world. This person was a biologist, taught for a while at Johns Hopkins University, and then worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Then this person sat down and wrote an elegantly written book about the death of certain animals due to chemicals and pesticides. It was the number one book on Book of the Month. It became a number one bestseller, and it was written by a woman, and it was the it created an awareness of the environment that the American people had never had before. Rachel Carson, Silent Spring. And it truly had it, as you see, came out in 1962. And frankly, prior to the publication of this book, the American people were not that aware of what was happening to the environment. This book had, and it was on the bestseller list for many, many months, more than a year. And Rachel Carson, and I think legitimately so, has been called the mother of the modern environmental movement, a book of profound influence. Next book. Our author is a native of Illinois, born in 1921. The author's father owned a jewelry store. The author was Jewish. Brilliant student in school, but this person, because she was a woman, was constantly teased for being very bright. And she was teased and miserable in high school. And people picked on her, particularly boys. But she went to Smith College, and there, for the first time, she remarked that she wasn't regarded as a freak because she had brains. And she made Phi Beta Kappa. She graduated near the top of her class. She went to graduate school at the University of California in Berkeley and was working on a PhD in psychology. But she turned down a full fellowship and resigned school to get married. She married a public relations director in 1947, and they had three children. And she became, within a few years, very bored and frustrated by being just a housewife. And she began to write articles about what women should do with life. And she said she felt guilty about writing whenever she took time away from her children. She felt guilty about it. And she was unhappy with her lot. And she finally published a book that more or less expressed her frustration and the frustration that a lot of women had during that time. And this book has said it was the spark that led to the modern women's movement. Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique. And for many women, particularly when it came out in 1963, said that book was an epiphany. It truly was an epiphany. I finally got it. And it truly had a tremendous amount of influence on women in the 1960s and moving forward. And she has been called the mother of the modern women's movement in America. All right, next. This person was born in 1909, and he graduated from, it's a he graduated from the Stanton Military Academy. Now, Stanton, Virginia, where Mary Baldwin College is, there was a boys' prep school, Stanton Military Academy. This person graduated from SMA in the 1920s. He went back to work with his family in the department store business in Phoenix, Arizona. He rose to president of the company. And then in 1949, he entered politics and was elected to the city council in Phoenix. And then in 1952, he was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he served until 1964. And then he came back to the Senate and served from 1968 to 86. And he wrote a book in which he said that we should not be feel guilty. There seems to be a theme here. We should not feel guilty for being conservative. And this was, of course, have you read the book? And he said that the real Americans are conservatives, and that the Republican Party had been captured by the liberal Eastern establishment. The Democratic Party was socialist. In a nutshell, that's what he said. And Ronald Reagan later said that this was one of his favorite books and had a profound influence on his thinking and activism. What is it? Barry Goldwater, Conscience of a Conservative. And many people, William F. Buckley, cite this. You'll see this in anthologies of conservative literature, and this is always there. And I think one could argue that this generated the emergence of the conservative wing of the Republican Party beginning in the 1960s, and that increased. All right, here's my last book, and then we're going to do some also-rans, and then we're going to open it up for discussion. The last book on my list was published by a native of Connecticut. The parents of this author were Lebanese immigrants. He graduated from Princeton and then Harvard Law School. And in the year 2000, Time magazine listed him as one of the 100 most influential Americans of the 20th century. And he became very concerned about safety standards in America, particularly with the automobile. And people were, as a matter of fact, a member of his family had been killed in a car wreck. And he took after the automobile industry, particularly General Motors, to the extent that they hired private detectives to follow him around. But he kept saying that these cars are being produced with no sense of safety, and the automobile industry was the worst of all. And another hint, I think, who are we talking about? Ralph Nader in the book? Unsafe at Any Speed. And it was after this book came out that you begin to have for the first, I was born in 1946. It wasn't until mid-1960s that we had seatbelts in the cars. And when I was a little kid, we would drive, and my parents would put me on a little box between my mother and father. And, you know, people just didn't, I know Cammy, my wife's family, they had a Chevrolet 210, and the column for the steering wheel pointed right into the chest with no seatbelt, Nader said we shouldn't do that, and as a result, in 1965, when the book came out, there were 5.2 deaths for every million deaths in the United States. For every million deaths in the United States, 5.2 were attributed to automobile accidents. By 1997, that had dropped to 1.7 per 1 million, and the latest I saw that it is down to about 1.2 per million. And he has been called the father of the modern consumer movement, that the consumer has certain rights to safety. Now let me mention some also-rans and I will wrap this up. This is an also-ran. We won't put them up yet. Oh, go ahead. That's one. This is Ida Tarbell, who was a muckraker, who wrote about the history of Standard Oil and monopolies, and one could argue that the publication of this led to the breakup of many of those monopolies. Liz Holo. I have one book related to religion. Now, I've been tempted to put this on my main list by an American in America, and it has had profound influence in this country and worldwide now. And it is the only book of what you would call revelation, a revelation from God. Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon. And it is now one of the fastest growing religions in the world, Again, I've been thinking about putting this number one on the list. It has sold millions of copies, but the Book of Mormon. Another book on my list, we'll save these, we'll put them all up at once. Another book on my list had a profound influence on Hugh Hefner. Yeah, there. The Kinsey Report, Sexual Behavior. It came out in 1948. And I'll tell the story. Cammy's parents were newlyweds. They went out and got the Kinsey Report. They were so excited they were going to read it. But it was nothing but dry, dull charts. And they were very disappointed with it. But it was the first book ever published widely and to the general public dealing with sexuality. People just didn't talk about that. And Hugh Hefner said he read that book and it had a profound influence, which led to Playboy. And I may move that up to my list as well. Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma, The Negro Problem in Modern Democracy. He talked about the inequities of segregation, the inequities and the inefficiency, the extreme cost monetarily of segregation. The Kinsey Report, Myrdal. Another one I have is Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And then one I've just added based on, do you ever hear Garrison Keillor do, he had one on there, Noah Webster's, The Compendious Dictionary of the English Language and later the American Dictionary of the Dictionary of the American Language, which talked about the unique form of American words and languages. Now, let me ask you this. I said there's nothing on my list within the last 48 years. What's been published in the last 48 years would you think it may have influenced the course of history? Think about that for a minute. And will it continue to be books? Will there be other forms of media that will influence? I mean, obviously so. The reason I ask this, we have Ken Burns coming and speaking at the Historical Society October 23rd. And we had him before, and I had an opportunity to talk to him. He told me an interesting story, that he had talked to Norman Schwarzkopf, and a few days before we invaded Iraq in the early 1990s, they watched his series, The Civil War. And if you've watched that series, the overwhelming amount of death in the Civil War, it's just incredible. If you've been to the Vietnam Wall, if you did one for the Civil War, you'd have to stack it up another 70 times. So they watched that. And it had a profound influence. And Schwarzkopf said that's one of the reasons we pulled back. Enough people had died. We had seen so much slaughter. And that series, now that's what Ken Burns said. And it makes you wonder, will there be other things like television programs, other forms of presentations that will have an influence on history? But the last remark I will leave you with is that many of you, I wonder how many of you in this room will publish a book. I bet you that in this room of bright Jefferson scholars, somebody, at least one of you, will publish a book. I don't know if you've thought about that. You probably haven't. But what will it be? And wouldn't it be interesting if somebody sitting in this room tonight published a book that changed the course of American history? And 100 years from now, somebody can give this talk and say, Bailey or Katie or somebody else wrote that book that changed the course of history, or Paul. But think about it. Books do and can change the course of history. Thank you very much. Write that book. Questions? Always somebody says, why didn't you put such and such on your list? Yes, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Do you feel, in your work at large, do you feel the need to kind of repudiate the historians who suggest that there are big general trends in history that are moving us toward, like a Hartz or something like that, who says, listen, liberalism...
Right, right.
There are great books that are published.
Yeah.
They have influence, but whether they actually, yeah. You know, change the course of history is a pretty big goal. What's your main tactic to refute those?
It's a good question. When I was in graduate school in the 1970s, there was a de-emphasis on individuals changing the course of history, and there were great social movements. And I tend to lean more toward the individual having an impact on history. I really do. I think there are any number of examples of that. Had there not been an Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War would have been very different. Had there not been a Franklin Roosevelt, it would have been very different. We can get into this. Had Al Gore been elected president in 2000, things would have been very different. Obviously, there are things like weather and climate. They clearly affect the course of history, change the course of history. But individuals do make a difference. In that book I'm starting to work on, I'm really becoming more and more convinced of that. That we individually have an influence, and people influence our lives on a micro scale. So I lean more toward the. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but just generally, so big trends like the trend towards liberalism,
Yeah.
I think that just happens to be a confluence of individuals trending in that direction, or are there big social movements, right, that supersede?
The big social movements are caused by a collection of people.
I'm sympathetic to that. I agree with you.
And usually based on some form of communication.
Right.
Movements are based on the words and thoughts of other people. And unless it's something like weather or economic collapse, which are based on the decision of people, it's an accumulation of the decision of individuals. But some of those individuals can have a much greater influence than others. Hitler. Would what have happened in the 1920s and 30s and 40s happen without a Hitler? I mean, we could debate that all day long. And who influenced him more than anybody else? Does anybody know? Who was regarded as the great dictator of the 1920s and 30s? It wasn't Hitler. Mussolini, absolutely. He had a profound influence on Hitler, and one could argue without a Mussolini as a model, there may not have been a Hitler. So I'm more of an individualist. Question back here. Yes?
Thank you very much for your speech. Do you think, now, why not qualify as a private public bank?
That is Tocqueville's The Democracy in America, published 1835, is one of my favorite books. And he has a whole chapter on volunteerism and the uniqueness of the American system. I think, but using my criteria that led to legislation, changed public opinion, we can clearly say there was a turn in history. I don't see how it did that. I think it made Americans, intellectual Americans, realize the uniqueness of America. And it was an interesting observation of our country and our people and our traditions from the viewpoint of a foreigner, which is instructive. But did it change the course of history? I don't think so. I would argue not. Yes?
Thank you very much for doing this. I know I didn't have that meeting that close. But I was wondering, in coming up with your criteria, were there any additional criteria in addition to the legislation, public opinion, that you wanted to include but for some reason did not decide to include, and if so, why?
No, but do you have any ideas? I'm open to ideas.
I guess, again, the bias being I'm an engineer, wondering how, I see a lot of great things changing public opinion, but I also know that in the past there was a lot of advancements that changed public behavior.
Exactly.
And I was wondering how come that might have not been included in your criteria. I was just wondering.
I guess we could say that there are books on science and engineering that I could add to my list. And unfortunately, I'm what you would call a POH. I'm a plain old historian. But if you have any ideas of books relating to science, engineering, that we could say this was published, and I'm sure there are, I would be very interested in knowing what those are, and I could possibly add those to my list. Excellent question. Yes.
I'm interested in exploring some of the possible mechanisms that connect the written word to your work, well, legislation,
yeah,
and action. I'm especially curious about the beginning part of the list, because when Common Sense was published, the majority of people in America couldn't read. Is it that the books got to the right people that mattered?
Yeah.
Or is it that the books kind of had a broad influence? Because obviously as we proceed through the list, getting to some of the later ones, more and more people are reading. What about the earlier portion of the list that going to be?
I think it's true throughout my list. 1950, which in total scheme of things isn't that long ago, almost half of the American population did not have a high school degree. And that's hard to believe. And as you go farther back, the number of people who were educated is even less. So I think what we say in terms of their influence, it influenced those who were literate, and those who were in control of government or in control of business or whatever. That's where the influence was. It wasn't among the masses. And I think that would be, to a great extent, that would be true today. Most people don't vote. people who tend to vote tend to be more educated, more involved, more literate. So the farther back you go, fewer people are educated, but that would continue all the way up into the 50s and 60s. And related to that, this is a little off the subject, people say history, that the American people, particularly young people your age, don't know history like they used to. I would argue that you are no less or no more ignorant of history than generations 50 years ago. And maybe you're maybe even more educated in relation to history and other subjects than we were 50 years ago, because people were not as well educated and as educated as extensively. Yes, right there.
Thank you for your speech. Also, do you think that for your list or in the future that a work of fiction could be included on there, and why not?
Well, the jungle's fiction. And Uncle Tom's Cabin's fiction. And what else?
It's more fiction than what's on. Can you
think of? I'm always open for ideas. If you have any other works of, all right, in the back, and then I'll go to you. Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Brian.
Yes.
One work of fiction I could think of would be Richard Wright's Native Son.
Yeah.
Which would have had to the problem of race, possibly like the American dilemma.
Yeah. I'll tell you another one that had a profound influence on white Southerners was To Kill a Mockingbird. It had a greater influence on white Southerners than it did than African Americans in the South. Yes.
Well, I'd like to thank you for your wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
I've read a lot of books about this.
Sure.
Good, refreshing on my memory. A lot of these books. But I wanted to ask you did have a book about the American Negro. I'd like to also ask you, what was your opinion on such influential novels like The Souls of Black Folk by the Boys, or The Narrative of a Slave by Frederick Douglass?
I should legitimately add them to my list. Native Son in particular would be, of all of those, would be the most important. Very good point. Uncle Tom's Cabin, of course, is written by a white woman. And good, I will add that to my list. Good point, yes.
Thank you for your speech. Just curious, did you consider the book of Roots for your list, and if so, why?
I was a good personal friend of Alex Haley's. His book had a profound influence on creating an awareness among African Americans and white Americans of their family history and genealogy. And it created an awareness of heritage that to a great extent had not existed before. Did it have a great effect on changing the course of American history? I would say Soul of Black Folks would be more influential than Roots. Okay. Yes. Wait, Bailey, you've been...
Dr. Brian, thank you so much again for coming tonight. You've talked about books that have influenced national history. Mm-hmm. But we happen to go to a university that is located in the Great Commonwealth of Virginia, which arguably the best state in the country. What would you say is the most influential book that's come out of Virginia giving the criteria that you've established for this list of books?
Come solely out of the state of Virginia?
Or that's influenced state history the most?
Influenced Virginia history? Oh. I tell you, this may sound unusual, but I would say Douglas Southall Freeman's biography of Robert E. Lee, because it reinforced what we call the cult of the lost cause, that Lee was the great hero, the perfect man, the marble man. It was a bestseller. He won the Pulitzer Prize for it. And I would argue that his book had more to do in influence in shaping public opinion in Virginia in the 20th century. It reinforced an old Virginia that was ironically beginning to die out in the 20th century. Any other ideas? That's a great question. You agree?
I'd say Virginia's death. But I guess in terms of the criteria.
Yeah. Yeah, Virginius Dabney's history. And I knew V. Dabney very well before he died. He was a white Southern liberal. All right, any more? Okay. Yes, in the back, but Virginia time.
I guess I have two short questions. I guess the book that I thought was really influential was The Invisible Man by Ellis.
I couldn't.
Yes, yes. And I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on that and how it affected history. And also, I heard you say the effect of possibly like missing meetings and things like that on history. And I was wondering if you possibly subscribe at all to chaos theory.
First question, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man was one of the most interesting books I've ever read. He goes as a white man in the South. I would still say the other book is more influential, but chaos theory. I'll tell you very briefly. I don't know if any of you have had a profound turning point yet. Most people don't have a profound turning point, I argue, until they get to college. My first one was my father's death when I was 8 years old. He was a musician and composer. He had a piece premiere at Carnegie Hall. He had a brilliant music career ahead of him. Had he lived, my life would have been very different. I know it would have been because of he was 43 years old. Was his death part of chaos theory? I don't think so. But it was a clear turning point in my life. Having Cammie's dad as my math professor and flunking his course and having to come back to summer school and flunking chemistry, I wouldn't say that was my own chaos. But I would not say that's part of the chaos theory. Can you give me an example of where you would think a turning point would... But I thought the question was, can I apply chaos theory to the turning points? Or maybe I misunderstood.
No, I was just thinking in general, kind of on like a historical case, for instance, Fulton Sinclair, I think he was probably, this might just be a random anecdote that isn't true, but I feel like the Packer story that he's eating meat, he kind of like bones in it or something. There was a guy who actually found a human finger in his meat. And I guess possibly that itself is a series of events that's not in Sinclair, right?
I'd say that's a combination of serendipity and epiphany. Yeah. There's another. Let's see. Let's get some other people in the back there.
Thank you very much once again. Being a PhD candidate in history, I'm wondering if you can say a few things about the impulse of Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, part of the student movement in America in the 1960s.
I cannot. Okay. Can you tell us briefly?
It was, first of all, like a quick bio on Fanon and his book. Fanon was originally Martinican, but he served in the French army as a psychiatrist during the
war. Okay, yeah, yeah.
And he wrote this book. He actually switched sides. He went over to the Algerian resistance and wrote this book, which was widely read by radical movements around the world in the 1960s, and specifically the ones around here. Actually a form.
Yeah.
Elevated their thinking in terms of describing themselves as a revolutionary.
So you would put that on your list?
I certainly would.
Okay, right here. Yeah.
Going back to a science book maybe, it is Thomas Paine's destruction of scientific revolution.
He's saying no. Go ahead.
A question about maybe revolutions regarding maybe the black civil rights movement. You mentioned obviously slavery, but not necessarily as well as disability movements with respect to.
Yeah, that's a good point. I cannot think of a publication that led to changes in disability, the ADA Act. There may be something, but I'm not aware of a book. Now that I have Parkinson's, I'm very much aware of that issue myself. And you have to put yourself in either your own shoes, but I don't know. That's a good question. It might be worth my pursuing to see. I'll come back to you, but we got to give...
There's someone else.
Are you and then you.
Thank you very much for your speech today. Yeah. Someone I really enjoyed it. But you spoke briefly at the end about also other mediums that would be influential. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on photography, particularly photojournalism,
Are you interested in photography? Yeah. It's a good question because we're opening a major exhibition on the history of photography in Virginia in about a month in the earliest known photographs. Photographs have had a profound influence. Photograph and the moving image. During the 1960s, those images of civil rights demonstrators in Birmingham being hosed, that had a profound influence. World War II, the deaths of the soldiers in New Guinea had a profound influence. So I think the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. So there are any number of examples of that. It reminds me of something about communication. And up until this is a trivia question. I'll see if anybody can get this. Up until the late 1960s, written correspondence was prevalent in the United States and in the rest of the world. Cammie was a student at Mary Ball. When I was at VMI, I wrote her a letter every day. We still have those letters. I wrote my mother a letter at least once a week. Correspondence, but it died in the 1970s and 1980s. What killed it? What about the telephone killed it? What do you think about the telephone kill correspondence? Long distance. Used to, long-distance phone calls were very expensive, and they were exotic. You wouldn't talk more than 3 minutes, and then the rates went way down. And you can trace the rates of the telephone call, the long-distance calls, with the death of correspondence. But within the last 10 years, correspondence has revived. How? Email. And it's interesting, there's a dip. The only problem with, and I'm speaking as a historian, director of a historical society, collecting the information of the past. It has gone up, but we can't capture that. But people now write more than they did, as much as we did in the 70s and 80s. But that's totally off. That's right. Right there. Yes.
Thank you so much for coming out.
Yeah.
I have a quick question regarding, given the criterion that you laid out, what piece of literature, in your opinion, in your research, has had the greatest effect on the moral values and moral principles of the individual?
Of the individual, of an American book. I'm not a Mormon. I would say of the books on my list, I would say the Book of Mormon. Not that we all agree, but it has had a profound influence on a growing number of people throughout the world. Do you have anything in mind? I'd be interested. Excluding the Bible or the book, the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the Book of Mormon will be limited to individuals who happen to have read it.
Right. You're talking about a book that was widely... Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. Anybody have any ideas? Book that had an influence on morality in America? He published... Yeah, he did, but... He published, they were ghostwritten for him. So, but I don't know. That's an excellent question. If you chose any book, it would be the Bible, I would say. Yeah. Yes.
Would you consider as a Jonathan?
Yeah. But, I mean, how many in this room have read Jonathan Edwards? Okay. All right, we go to the football game tomorrow. We ask. Yes, Paul.
Thanks for this wonderful presentation. And I mean, top 10 list. I mean, we could talk about this all night. It's a great way to go. And it seems like a great follow-up would be the top 10 films, like say of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And so.
Tell you my favorites.
In suggesting that, well, what I want to also suggest is there might be something that's a link between the two. At one point, I did a study on American literature.
Yeah.
Kind of looked based on these criteria, and I ran into Thomas Dixon Jr.
Ooh.
And his writing of the Leopard Spots and the Klansman goes on. He's a friend of Woodrow Wilson, who was president of the Hall at one point, and goes on to be the basis for Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
Right, which becomes the first movie shown in the White House, and Hollywood is born from this movie. And so that would be kind of one text that would actually connect the top 10 film list with your top 10 historical.
Two of the most influential movies of the 20th century both dealt with the Civil War, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, which it reinforced stereotypes about the Old South. All right, let's see. Wait a minute. Let's get some people. I'll come back to you guys, but you have not asked a question yet.
Thanks for your contribution. As an engineer, I couldn't really connect with a lot of points. Like, my brother is a big student. I kind of got a little bit. This is a lot of my knowledge. But going back to the question of scientific writing.
Yeah.
I found that there seems to be a lot more interest these days in general scientific writing.
In
history of time,
yeah.
More recently in Richard Dawkins' earlier work, just on biology, and kind of the expansion of scientific writing and trying to apply science into social areas as well. How do you see this? Would you speculate on perhaps what would happen if that trend continues in the future, or how you see that having influence on society?
I think there's a trend that in the last many years of making scientific writing available and understandable by the general masses. If you looked at scientific writing a century ago, for example, it was probably scientific writing for scientists. And it was not that well understood by the general public, but the books you cited are, for one, they were written to sell books, and they were written, Carl Sagan is another example. He was criticized by many of his colleagues for being too much of a generalist. But Carl Sagan made the cosmos and made astronomy interesting and to some degree understandable among the general public. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that the ability to communicate a very complex subject for most of us into general terms is a gift, and that will have more influence on shaping public opinion than the pure scientific books. All right, let's see, here and then there.
Sorry.
All right.
I apologize
for not wanting to. Is there any quota on questions?
I wonder if I could just push you a little further on...
No, you're not chaos theory. So.
on the actual causal mechanism that you see in books and changing history, because I think you can make a pretty good argument that these books, which you've outlined, that are great and really interesting, just kind of symptomatic of the kind of changes that are going on in history at the time, or reflective of deeper undercurrents changing, or that are really moving history. What exactly is it about these books that has altered or changed?
All right, one could use a counterfactual. And that you could use a counterfactual in every instance. Had Ralph Nader not published Unsafe at Any Speed, more than likely there would have been safety standards, but would they have happened right then and there within the next? Because it's within 2 or 3 years after that book is published that it creates this awareness among the public. And wait a minute, I hadn't thought of this. And you clearly see the legislation coming about within 2 or 3 years in his book cited in the arguments for the legislation. Uncle Tom's Cabin, had it not been published, would we have still had a civil war? Probably. But I think it still did shape the thinking of people in the North. The Federalist, counterfactual there, had they not been published? That's a tough one. I could argue that maybe the public opinion would not have been swayed. So I think you would have to apply that counterfactual standard to each one of those, as you do with anything. And some are stronger than others. Would you agree?
Yeah.
I'll wink at you like the debate last night. I'll get back to you later on that.
I'd also like to apologize for not buzzing down as well.
Okay.
I was going to actually ask something about Southern culture and literature, like Robert Pinmore and talk.
Yeah.
However, I was thinking perhaps why there weren't any poetic or any poetic literature or any wits, perhaps transcendentalist movement poets involved with it.
Yeah.
Or perhaps, you know, something else like
Thoreau.
Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
Perhaps more recent movements such as Winston Hughes or Fulton's poetry or anything like that.
Well, there's one reason. You could add those to the list, but the list becomes so big that if you were to give a talk in 40 minutes, you'd just be doing one. And next, and next, and next. You try to make it so you can at least talk a little bit about them. And every time I give this talk, there are more books I could add to it. And, I think there is fiction and literature on here, but the books you cited, you mentioned. Yeah, under my criteria, I'm not sure how Poe changed the course of history or influenced the course of history. They're interesting reading, but did they influence legislation? Did they change the public thinking about something? I don't think so.
Perhaps, and one poem I can remember from Song of Myself by Whitman, where he talked about the beauty of watching an African slave perhaps feels. And you know, maybe you could think of the same way that made him change people's public opinions of certain issues or of the life.
Well, I would, you know, it's interesting. I would argue that music and songs maybe had a greater influence than poetry. Music is more widespread. I know when we were at Vietnam and at VMI, it was during Vietnam. My favorite song was "We Gotta Get Out of This Place." If it's the last thing, and it just reinforced, you know, we got to get the hell out of here. And there are certain songs, again, that I think are more influential than poetry. All right, I'm going to take two more, and then I'm about to run out of gas here. So, there in the back with the bow tie. Well, it's not American. That's right. Scotsman outside of the United States. Over here, I have not called on you, I don't.
Thank you for your speech.
Sure.
I guess my question is, why did you choose to limit yourself to just American published books?
I'm American history by training. I don't feel as comfortable getting outside of it. Somebody ought to do one on books that change the course of world history. What would some of them be? All right. Yeah. Das Kapital. The Republic. Mein Kampf. The Prince. All right, this is your assignment. Somebody in this room give the books that changed the course of world history. Thank you very much. Beat the terms tomorrow.